Maggie Thatcher was always ready to be articulate in her condemnation of Israeli barbarism or atrocities. Go forward to today, Israel has a partly fascist government now, yet the Conservative Party and the Labour government as well are much more friendly or well-disposed towards what is a far more barbarous apartheid government. Britain's special relationship with America has taken us into a terrible place. When you're dealing with the terrible events in Gaza, where we're supplying arms and so on and giving diplomatic cover, you are paying a heavy and horrible moral price, a betrayal of everything which Britain claims to be. For a long time, we had a cross-party cartel in Britain. The Labour and the Tories took the identical position. These marches, they're in the tradition of the Chartists, the suffragettes. These are part of what it is to be British. Paradoxically, it's the British media and the government, which the British media has been supporting in all of this, who are standing for the destruction of the international moral order, for barbarism.
Peter O'Born, welcome to Politics Show.
Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure.
The pleasure's all mine. We're here to talk about your new book, out today, did you say?
It's in fact published today, yes.
Today, Complicit: Britain's Role in the Destruction of Gaza. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic read, a real page-turner. For anyone watching this now that isn't familiar with you, your work, how would you like to introduce yourself?
It's nice of you to give me the opportunity to describe myself. I've had a long and meretricious career in political journalism. I was political editor of The Spectator, as chief political commentator of The Daily Telegraph. I've been, what other marvellous things have I done? I was commentator for the Daily Mail. But now I write for the Middle East Eye, a column for them, which is a column which takes generally pro-Palestinian view of what things which are going on in Gaza and the West Bank. And I write occasionally for Declassified and Byline Times. And I write quite a lot of books. Mm-hmm. This is the latest.
And what books they are?
I've written several books on cricket. Mm. My first book was a investigative book, really, into Basil D'Oliveira, who was a, as it was called in the 50s and 60s, a coloured cricketer in South Africa.
Right.
And he was a bit of a genius. But under apartheid, you were invisible. You weren't even supposed to play cricket, and in the doctrinally, you weren't any good. Mm. And so Basil sort of played cricket for on these wretched pitches. Nobody saw him, and then he was the first ever captain of what really is the South African cricket team, because there was a non-racial cricket team.
Yeah,
which wasn't whites, although whites could have played had they wanted to, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And it went up East Africa, and he was captain. He was a magic. And then he gets to his early 30s, and his friends are saying to him, look, you can't get, you, the only way you can get to a cricket, first class cricket match in South Africa is as a spectator, not just as a spectator in a cage, because that's where they put the blacks.
Yeah.
And Basil, he writes these green ink letters. There was a green ink to the greatest cricket writer, commentator of all time, John Arlott, from Cape Town. And Arlott amazingly reads these letters and takes them seriously. Gets Basil a job in English league cricket, which is low. But once he's there, it's like having, you know, an unexploded bomb, because he's a genius. Mm-hmm. Even though he's getting on a bit, and he goes up the ladder, he gets chosen for England, and then lo and behold, there's the forthcoming England tour of South Africa, and that clashes with all the doctrines of racism. Anyway, I wrote the book, and it basically leads to the end of South Africa as a as a cricketing sporting nation, because it's out. Funnily enough, it's quite the themes. Some of the themes here are similar because it's the complicity which I revealed. I got into the archives of the Foreign Office and the South African archives, and I spoke to people. I revealed the complicity between the British political sporting establishment and the and the South African Prime Minister Foster. And at the heart of the book is these extraordinary treasure trove, really, of correspondence, which show, they, first of all, they tried to bribe, South Africa tried to bribe de Oliveira not to play.
Yeah.
When they failed that, they managed to nobble the British cricketing establishment with the aid of the British political establishment.
Incredible.
I know, it's, and it's, so there are kind, there are serious themes.
Yeah.
In this book, which are related to my book on Basil, who I took down. I went down to Cape, it was one of the most magical journeys of my life. I went down with Basil. I went down with him to Cape Town, very much at the end of his life, for the World Cup in 2003. And I basically was sort of minding him as well as, and the Mobeke, the South African president, launched the World Cup. And there were 40 people going out into the middle. 40 South African sports people in history. And leading it was Basil de Oliveira and Graham Pollock, who at the time was one of the greatest batsmen of all time, but his career was brought short by isolation. And I watched, I was in the stands, and I watched Basil walk out with Graham Pollock. And Graham Pollock did something so proper, and he stepped behind. He let Basil lead the way. And then I lost Basil, but I hunted him about half the evening, hunting him down. He was a little frail, you know, we were worried about
him. Of course.
And eventually I found Basil de Oliveira and Graham Pollock, these two great cricketers, great sports people, great human beings. They were, you know, I found, tracked them down to a little bar in the middle of Cape Town somewhere, and they were drinking and talking. And I had the amazing privilege of joining them. And I said to Graham, look, you would have been one of the greatest cricketers, greatest sportsmen of all time. It was all cut away from you by the exclusion of South Africa.
Yeah. I tell you what, that's probably going to be on my reading list next time.
And anyway, but it was Graham Pollock's answer. He said, look, it was painful at the time, but looking back on it, it was completely right. And that was, I thought he was on the wrong side of everything, but he acknowledges now very, very gracefully.
There's something in that there, yeah. It's also, as you say, completely apt with the book that we're talking about today. I wonder if I might start with a quote from the book, where you say, Britain, in short, has enabled Israel's criminal repression over decades while sabotaging each and every Palestinian attempt to resolve the conflict. In this way, we are not just complicit in the destruction of Gaza over the last 2 years, we also help pave the way for the horrors of October 7th itself. What did you mean when you wrote that?
One of the myths very successfully created by the supporters of Israel and those who apologize for it is that the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. There is this idea that they've been offered constant peace deals and solutions, which they've never taken. And one of the chapters in the book, I go through the prehistory of October the 7th, showing that actually the opposite is the case. Again and again, the Palestinians have wanted to do deals, and they've been cut away from. Israel doesn't really want to have a Palestinian state next door. And it's been an article, basically an article of policy. But because Israel, the supporters of Israel are so strong in the mainstream media, these deals, Camp David's one, been come up lately, it's presented a bit as Israel's turned its back on them. Sorry, the Palestinians turned its back on them, which is not right. And there have been a lot of opportunities for peace, for a deal, for a two-state solution, including big messages being sent out by Hamas after 2006, after the Israeli withdrawal. Mm-hmm. And they've never got anywhere, and they should have done. And if, had we had it, but there were tremendous opportunities for resolutions, and they were largely killed by Israel.
And where does Britain's complicity in those peace deals falling down?
Well, Britain has gone along with this narrative that there is no. The injured party in all of this is Israel. Mm-hmm. And I go through the British reactions to Carr-led, brutal Israeli attack on Gaza in 2008, in Protective Agent 2014, I showed the amazing, horrible disparity in civilian casualties. Mm-hmm. And I show again and again the British state will blame Hamas and it will not basically give a free pass. It will never condemn Israel's atrocities.
In that, you identify in the book that it seems to be a relatively recent aspect of Israeli-British relations, that there is this pinning of Britain to anything that Israel says about the matter. You mention Queen Elizabeth II, you mention Margaret Thatcher. In particular with Thatcher, it seems quite interesting to the reader that the government that we have in place now seems to be more pro-Israel than Margaret Thatcher was, or more undyingly supportive of Israel.
Yeah. This is the case. I mean, Thatcher was pro-Israel. Mm. And she was, she had a lot of Jewish people in her constituency. She was a ferocious opponent of anti-Semitism. But Maggie Thatcher, it's interesting, was always ready to be articulate in her condemnation of Israeli barbarism or atrocities, which was, and it was, he's very, that was in the early 80s, mid 80s. Now, if you go forward to today, Israel has a partly fascist government now. It's one of the, it's the most far right government in Israeli history. Mm. And yet the Conservative Party and the Labour government as well are much more friendly or well-disposed towards what is a far more barbarous apartheid government. It's an apartheid state. Everybody says so. The British government won't call it out. It's committing what the majority of experts now regard as a genocide. British government can't call it out, whereas Maggie Thatcher, when it was much less extreme government, was ready to call out Biden big time, mm-hmm. and suspend arms and tell him to stop doing it, not stop killing, mm-hmm. stop war crimes.
I wonder what you identify as the reason that there's this change. I mean, there's questions of lobbying, there's questions of allegiances to the United States, but where is the change coming from in British standing towards Israel?
I think the first biggest change in many ways of the last 40 years in this territory is the doctrine of neoconservatism. Mm. If you go back, which broadly speaking says that international law is a nonsense, is wrong. See, if you go back 40 years, the people who were running Britain, the United States, Israel, they'd all grown up in the 1930s, 40s as a whole. They'd seen World War II and the 1930s when everything went wrong. They'd seen the collapse of the League of Nations. They'd see what it meant not to have an international order which worked. And Maggie Thatcher was absolutely clear. You would never hear this from a modern politician. International law is all we've got. She gave a lecture to a Jewish journalist about this. Mm. Phenomenal lecture, actually. It's sort of there for all time, after he said, you're betraying Israel by condemning us. because Israel had bombed a nuclear reactor. And she said, international law is all we've got. And she speaks, that is somebody who grew up and went through World War II. Our current generation, I think they've forgotten all of this stuff. And the dominant hegemonic intellectual position is neocon. The neocons say, the international law is rubbish. It's all about us or them. That's their basic position. You're either us, our friends, or the enemy. And that has dominated, as we can see, with such awful effect, the US policy going back to the younger Bush. And it's become a central way in which the British Conservative Party and the Blairites have come to see the world. Mm-hmm. And the Blairites are now running the Labour, really.
Would you define the current government as kind of adopting that neoconservatism in a way? Because, I mean, a fan of British politics would say that the Labour government is the most left government that we've had in 15 years. But yet you have this divide between the domestic policies of a government, but then also interviews where the famous interview for LBC with Keir Starmer, basically saying that Israel have the right to cut off food and water to Gaza.
Collective punishment. They have the right to commit war crimes.
Yeah. And this is a man who's a former DPP. He had represented, as you point out in the book, Croatia at the ICC.
Mm-hmm. I think that Starmer's a bit of a mess, to be honest, in kind of conceptually, politically, policy-wise. Mm. But you can... I have a chapter on Starmer's politics, and I think as Prime Minister, as Labour leader, he took the view that in order to reassure the rest of the world, he had basically to do whatever the Americans did. He sort of shadowed the Biden administration in opposition, and that took him in, and that was his signal to his party, to the British media, to the establishment more generally, that, yeah, you can trust me, I'm reliable. And unfortunately, maybe it's bad luck on him, because Biden was, as we all know now, a pathetic figure who couldn't stand up to Netanyahu and thus allowed the slaughter to continue. And Starmer went along that very dreary, horrible path. I think that's the main thing which motivated Starmer vis-à-vis Israel, although he was also formed, and I think that this is also right, very relevant, by the Corbyn and the so-called anti-Semitism crisis. And so he was, having framed himself as a man who can deal with the anti-Semitism legacy of Corbyn, then to go into action criticizing Israel's atrocities, I think was difficult for him. And I think that also explains this awful moment when he's asked by Nick Ferrari on live radio, isn't he? But you can see it in YouTube, his face. He knows he's here. He's one of the most erudite human rights lawyers in the world. Starmer justifying collective punishment, and you can see all these. I think you can see all of those thoughts. What shall I say politically? But what is right in terms of facts? And he can't really cope with it. And the only way he resolves it is by saying we must obey international law, but it's okay to commit a collective punishment at the same time.
Mm-hmm. In terms of morality, then, where does that kind of have the leaders of the Western world in their response to this in the last 2 years, in the last 2 years, but also historically as well? I mean, Britain has got this history in the region. America kind of adopts in the 1970s the role that Britain had for quite a while. Whereas now there's kind of a moral question. It is a moral question at this point. If you've got a majority of human rights lawyers or experts in genocide defining something that's happening in Gaza, but a human rights lawyer that's leading the British government is reluctant to do the same.
I tell you, it's a very big central problem here. You have a On the one side, you have all the human rights organizations, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, but Salem in Israel, Al-Haq. You have the United Nations and its various agencies. You've got the Red Cross. All of them are saying, without exception, Israel is committing terrible war crimes. Most of them are saying Israel is committing genocide. Who is on the other side of that argument? Clearly, Netanyahu and the Israeli state. And furthermore, its allies, which happen to include the mainstream British press. Not all of them. There are exceptions. The Guardian has its good moments and its bad moments. The Financial Times, I think, has been very straight. But if you look at the Times, the Telegraph, the Mail, the Express, the Sun, and I'm afraid a lot of the time the BBC, it's been that they've kind of been on the side of Israel against international law.
Mm-hmm.
And because America is a rogue state and has been, of course, for a very long time, but under Trump, of course, it's now become a mad rogue state as well. But America has always taken itself out of the international system, the international institutional arrangements which have governed the West, apart from the UN, which it hates, but, you know, the International Criminal Court it won't join and so on. So America is hostile to the rule of law. And Britain's special relationship with America has taken us into a terrible place. So we've sided, generally speaking, with America, or been afraid to offend it, and therefore Israel, against, we've never stood up. I mean, it's horrible, this. It's deeply shameful. It's one of the deep reasons we're complicit. More than 300 UN aid workers have been murdered by the Israelis. We haven't said a word of complaint. The America has sanctioned the ICC, which is set up by us and other Western states in order to pursue war criminals. Have we complained about that? The chief prosecutor of the ICC is Karim Khan. It has been sanctioned. He's British. There's no complaint from Britain. Really disgusting smear campaigns has been launched against Guterres, the Secretary General of the UN, you know, anti-Semite, and the Pope, anti-Semitic, the late Pope, I should say. And no complaints. You know, we swim along in these waters.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sort of, and you can see what it is. It's calculation that we need to stay in with the United States. It's on our long-term interest. And people make that point. But when you're dealing with the terrible events in Gaza, where we're supplying arms and so on and giving diplomatic cover, you are paying a heavy and horrible moral price and betrayal of everything which Britain claims to be in order to support Israel in these circumstances.
Another one that came to my mind there was just this week, I think it was Tuesday, Francesca Albanese was addressing the UN, but from South Africa, because she's not allowed to enter the United States because she's sanctioned by the United States. But an interesting metaphor of all of it, I think, is the case in front of the ICC at the moment is being spearheaded by South Africa.
Mm.
And you've also got the special rapporteur giving this speech about international complicity from South Africa.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting tapestry of opposition to the way the international community is operating, it seems.
Yes, and I think it's so significant that South Africa brought their original case, the genocide case, because if you both apartheid and the United Nations and the Palestinian issue all start more or less exactly at the end of World War II, and for a long time Palestinian rights and the anti-apartheid cause were together in in sort of tandem. And then you get the momentous case before the International Court of Justice about South African apartheid in the mid-60s, which is one of the defining post-war cases, where ultimately the ICJ finds against the anti-apartheid, finds for South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
But then 50 years later, here is South Africa again, post-apartheid, coming back to make really what is the case for universal human rights. Not the human rights which the West wants, which is for a small group of largely white countries. Human rights for everybody, articulating the vision of Churchill and Roosevelt, actually, when they met off North Newfoundland on a boat, in 1941, in the darkest moment of World War II. And that universalist vision has been smashed over recent years. Again, we look at the rise of the new neocons. It's us or them.
Mm-hmm.
The Huntington thesis was another attack on the universal idea of human rights. It said, no, we're not talking about human rights. We're talking about clashes of civilizations. And and broadly speaking, with the clash between the Western civilization and East Islamist barbarism is one of the dividing lines which Huntington developed. So you, that again, frames right and wrong in a very different sort of way.
Mm.
And these deep themes lurk very much at the heart of this book.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to move on to the media, the British media. First of all, has the British media been almost compromised by the war in Gaza?
I don't know about compromised. It's I think found out. Let's say something. We're both journalists. I mean, the reason we become journalists, I think, is to tell the truth and to hold power to account. And if you look at, I set out in this book, I have basically three chapters on the media. And I show how it's failed to do that, I think an Israeli death is going to get on average 33 times more coverage than a Palestinian death. If you look at that famous headline, the deadliest day for Israel, which went everywhere, 24 Israeli soldiers killed in January the 22nd, 2024. The same day, 200 Palestinians were killed. And in fact, they just got a small para somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at the way that the British media has covered the deaths. And of Palestinian journalists, more than 200 have been killed, that is to say, by Israel. It's practically ignored. BBC, a study was made of it. The BBC reported 6% of Palestinian journalists' deaths. It's the dehumanization. Palestinians are turned as to... And then I look at the sheer bigotry of it. I mean, the language used by quite a number of respectable British journalists about Palestinians. It's beyond belief. We need to face reality. Much of Muslim culture is in the grip of a death cult that sacralizes bloodshed. That's one columnist, he did withdraw the tweet in the end.
Mm-hmm.
Admitting Gazan refugees would be proof that Britain has a death wish. That's the Daily Telegraph. The Islamist, plain and simple historic Islamic bloodlust and so on. It's very brutal and horrible language. Open support for ethnic cleansing in mainstream British organ. It's racist. I mean, I think you have to say the coverage of the whole Gaza genocide, which is the way that most experts now call it, has been racist, extremely racist.
There's also been, and you write about it as well in the book, the phenomenon of the any coverage that is attempting to shed light or show the truth of what happens there often is bombarded, is probably not the right word, but there is a lot of policing of the language of the media when it comes to Israel's conduct. Mm-hmm. And there's a there's an absence of that kind of activism.
No, quite. You know, I mean, the, particularly for the first year, there was Israel. You know, there would be these mysterious Palestinian deaths. Mm. Nobody explained why they died or who was responsible, who killed them. The language has been very. If you look at the look, Netanyahu is a wanted for alleged war crimes. How often does that get mentioned when they do reports? You know Trump is. You know, when Netanyahu met Trump, you know, you've got a convicted felon, and I met somebody who is wanted for war crimes. And then the media tells us they've done a peace deal. Mm. I mean, it's rubbish. Mm. You know, it's the two protagonists in the genocide have come together to sort something out between themselves. The Palestinians are nowhere. And look at the media coverage of all of that. It's just weird.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's the, to use the phrase, the Israeli lobby, you speak about that in the book. Mm-hmm. And acknowledging that it is used as a phrase, as an anti-Semitic trope. Mm-hmm. There is NGOs, focus group, or special interest groups that do often work to kind of put pressure on the media almost, or mm-hmm. to put pressure on governments. In the interest of Israel. Do you think that there's any cut through in the general public for these organizations? And if there is, or if there isn't, why do governments seem to be so disjointed with the public on that?
Well, you're asking several questions at once there, I think. Uh-huh. Why is there a difference between the position taken by governments and the position taken by ordinary voters. Mm. Is that right?
Yeah.
Because the governments, both in the United States, but very much so in Britain, have been in a completely different place from voters. The British voters have wanted a ceasefire from day one, whereas successive governments have been, generally speaking, supportive of Netanyahu since day one. There's mm-hmm. been a huge gap between the public and the voters. I think the main reason for that, I explained in the book, is the United States, because mm-hmm. Britain has this special relationship which has been so disastrous for us. I also look at the role of the Israel lobby, which is it's a technical point almost, because it's something which operates in where people are powerful. It's about affecting the British policy at the elite level, and it is a sensitive subject. You can fall very much so into anti-Semitic tropes writing about it, but it certainly does exist, and you can't understand a lot of policy decisions without understanding there is a powerful, highly influential lobby for Israel operating inside both parties. And I describe it in the how it works in the book.
And the sheer influence that lobby tends to have is kind of what's most jarring about the situation, is that there's such attention to detail put on things, like, again, whether it's the media, the reporting of atrocities, how governments react to atrocities, all seems to be done cautiously so as not to upset that lobby. For what reason do you think there's such care taken on that side?
I think that journalists, look, this is perfectly legitimate, what I'm going to describe now. If you, as a journalist for a mainstream paper, and you even make a tiny error, talking about Israel, there's going to be a letter, right? The letter is going to be written by influential papers, people to your paper saying, why on earth are you writing this? Why are you writing false stuff about Israel?
Mm-hmm.
And add that to the fact that the vast majority of journalists, and that included me for a long time, don't really understand what's going on in Israel, the West Bank, Gaza. You know, we don't know about, the 1967 and the Green Line and all of this. It's complex stuff.
Yeah.
And so they're writing about stuff they don't, we are, because I used to include me. I think I'm a bit more knowledgeable now. That if you make one mistake, you're going to get a call from the editor's office. What's gone on? Mm-hmm. You know, I've had a complaint. And if you don't watch it, you're going to get a complaint to IPSO. You know, and then you're going to get, and then there'll be a little paragraph somewhere, you know, and, now that's all perfectly legitimate. One of the points is that the Palestinian voice gets obliterated in all of this. If you write something wrong about Palestinians, there's nobody who's going to, kind of really come after you. Nobody cares if they do that because they're terrorists, aren't they? Or they're, and I do a real, study of this, how this works, that there is an incredibly important conservative Friends of Israel organization in the Conservative Party. About 80% of Tory MPs, they claim, exist.
Mm-hmm.
There is no such thing as a Conservative Friends of Palestine
mm-hmm.
until a tiny little thing has started a few years ago. And so when government policy, I looked at this bill, which was going to outlaw the Michael Gove, his Economic Activity of Public Bodies Bill, which is
to prevent people from boycotting occupied territory.
Yeah, basically the boycott, divestment and sanctions was going to be ruled out. You know, you couldn't, local councils or public bodies couldn't go down that route, which is, by the way, is a non-violent way of fighting oppression in the in the idea of people behind it, as opposed to killing. You know, it's got quite a lot to be said for BDS, I think. Now, this bill, I looked at the committee stage. You know, they invited the Conservative Friends of Israel, not the Conservative Friends of Palestine. They invited UK Lawyers for Israel, not Lawyers for Palestinian Human Rights, etc. It always goes on and on. A pro-Palestinian columnist, and we're not there, but the pro-Israeli columnist, yes, they were there, and so on. And it's completely bent.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at the membership of the committee, and they all know the conservative lobby groups, but they don't know the Palestinian lobby groups, and that's a bent system. It's not. It should be fair, you know. They should have heard both sides, but no, it's weighted against, heavily weighted.
Mm.
That's just one case study which I carry out
Someone who would push back on that argument might say that Britain's ally is Israel, and so Britain's interest would be to continue to support Israel and to represent the interests of Israel.
Yeah, it's an interesting argument that we operate, we're part of a global system which operates with our, which we benefit from, and therefore we should for naked reasons of power, or be on the side of Israel, America, Germany, France, or something. Very colonial way of looking at things, isn't it? It's, you know, you call me old fashioned, but I think right and wrong, you know, it does matter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not inconsistent, by the way, to say we're friends of Israel, but you, as Maggie Thatcher did, but if you, the sort of rocket she handed out to Begin in 1982, or suspending arms, as Britain has often in the past. But, why can't we do that again?
Mm-hmm.
But that's apparently something which is on a great affront to our friends. But we've done this repeatedly, suspended arms sales to Israel in the past, not now.
And just in terms of how we've seen on the streets these physical manifestations, protests, people have become completely aware of the situation and want to act. Not just in the UK, across the globe. How significant do you think that people power is going to be in exposing complicity?
Yes, one of the dirtiest aspects of the last 2 years has been the political media treatment of the protesters who, week after week, have been turning up on British streets, protesting against, calling for peace and protesting against British government policy, sale of arms and so forth. They've been represented as the as sort of terror supporters, anti-Semites, woke, kind of enemies of the state, anti-Western. And it's a very important role played here by the mass media, the mainstream media, because they led these attacks on the hate marches and they amplified the political attacks. And the importance of the marches is that for a long time we had a cross-party cartel in Britain. The Labour and the Tories took the identical position. It did become more nuanced later on, that Netanyahu must be supported at all costs. How were you, in the face of that, how were you to protest as an ordinary person who felt there was something deeply wrong about Britain's support for Israel's barbarity? And that was a take to the streets. And that space had to be, they had to be smeared, and they were. The media went after them week after week, attacking them as rancid enemies of everything that was decent. And one of the reasons I, the longer I got involved in writing this book, the more I felt that these people are heroes. For me, as a journalist, the heroes of the book have to be the Palestinian journalists who gave their lives to tell the truth. But these marchers, they were, they're in the tradition of the Chartists, the suffragettes, Stop the War people, Ban the Bomb, the Jarrow March. These are part of what it is to be British, these protest marches. And also, in a deep irony, they're standing up for the international moral order. Well, they're standing up for the United Nations, the International Criminal Court, the idea of justice, the idea of supporting the underdog. And it's paradoxically, it's the British media and the government, which the British media has been supporting in all of this, who are standing for the destruction of the international moral order, for barbarism.
To continue just briefly on the media, one topic recently in the UK was the West Midlands Police decided to ban Maccabi Tel Aviv fans from attending the game next week in Birmingham. And you write in the book about a previous incident in Amsterdam and how the media covered that and how the kind of the political levers of whether it was the local government in Amsterdam, national governments across the world, the Israeli government, Israeli ambassadors reacted and kind of shaped a narrative around an event that seems to an observer that that was almost the attempt with the West Midlands Police.
I'll tell you, what I did in Amsterdam, and I did it very thoroughly, is that there was a piece of footage of Maccabi fans going after, beating up, etc., chasing a local Dutch. And it was put out on British, and by the way, rather world TV, as the exact opposite. As Dutch chasing Maccabi, and that's an incredible failure in basic professionalism, and it's completely misleading to the public, and it sort of set the scene for what happened for the Aston Villa game. Now, I'm sure that many of the Maccabi fans are fantastically decent people, but a number of them were singing death to Arabs. Worse than that, they were getting involved in violence. And so but they were getting kickback. I'm not saying it was all one time, but the death to Arabs and also just mocking the dead children of Gaza during what many people regard as a genocide. Mocking. They had songs about dead children. Yeah. Genocidal songs. And the West Midland Police reached this decision that it would be best not to have them in Birmingham, actually, isn't it? For the game. And Starmer got involved, waded in, backed by the British media, and said, no, they should come. This is anti-Semitic not to let them in. Now, I can't understand why Starmer got involved there, because, you see, do we really want... Imagine if it was they went around shouting death to blacks. Would we allow football hooligans coming in, marching through Birmingham streets, Brixton Street, shouting death to blacks? Mm-hmm. And during during the slaughter that's going on, when more than 20,000 children are now thought to have died, just mocking the dead children of Gaza, do we really want that? Genocidal songs on British... I can't understand, A, the decision by the British Prime Minister, or let alone the coverage in the British media, which was largely supporting Mr. Starmer.
It does speak to two aspects of all the complicity, though, doesn't it? Where there's one side that is willfully misrepresenting the facts that the police have decided that this is a security risk. Mm. It has happened at football games before. It's happened at football games in the UK before. Mm. To then imply that is an anti-Semitic decision, it possibly goes as far to undermine or to be anti-Semitic in itself. To say that the reason the people that are being banned from this are a representative of all Jews, but also to speak in the House.
Yeah, that's an anti-Semitic presumption, actually. That many Jews I know for certain are absolutely horrified by the conduct of the Mac, and they are not representative of Judaism. Absolutely not. That there are Israeli football fans. All countries have terrible fans. We all know that, but. I think the language around this was very misleading and bad and divisive from the British Prime Minister.
But it's also the, I think, particularly in the genocide that's ongoing, the British public, one would argue, are a lot more aware and a lot more acutely educated on Palestine and Gaza and Israel, presenting these news stories in a way that's misrepresentative does not seem to work anymore, or it doesn't seem to have the same kind of cut through, or there's a disconnect between government messaging and public understanding when it comes to Israel.
That is justified, because there was a poll, I think YouGov carried it out, which showed that the British public was supportive of the West Midlands police. Mm-hmm. And not the Downing Street intervention. I would add here, though, that you can see it fits into the general strategy of the Starmer government, which is, generally speaking, to pillory Muslims as sort of terror supporters. Mm-hmm. That has been the language used by Starmer and his allies, the country of strangers, the language used by his advisors, shaking off the fleas about Muslim voters. And there is a deep Islamophobia, and it's part of, I think, the Downing Street electoral strategy commandeered, as far as I can tell, by Morgan McSweeney from Cork, I believe.
Mm, and, that's right.
Yes, and which I think is quite shocking, to intervene in communalism of this kind in such a divisive way, and China is and targeting that MP, Ayub Khan, who an independent Muslim MP, and you saw a lot of the media rhetoric which came off it, which was straightforwardly racist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just in wrapping up, do you think that in all, whether it's international complicity, whether it's domestic complicity, the actions of the media, the actions of the state, the language of politicians, do you think that any British politician will face any repercussions in an international court for their conduct during the genocide?
I think they will, yes. You can look at the way the ICC, the International Criminal Court, is being targeted by the United States. It may be that he can actually knock it out of business. because it's, they're going to sanction it. How's he going to pay its bills? But I think somewhere it's going to happen. South Africa, we are seeing a mood which I think is not properly understood. It is understood in Ireland. Spain is starting to understand it. You saw the remarkable events, sort of popular manifestations of support for Palestinians in Genoa, in Italy. You're starting to see this, a change of consciousness around the world, but it's not yet understood, I think, in Britain, in among British politicians, in the United, you know, in the White House, in Germany and so on, but they don't understand. But there is a feeling across the world, to use a bit of a cliche phrase, the global south, there is a major feeling that justice is not being carried out by the West. The West is supporting something terrible. I do think it's possible, or even likely now, that the International Criminal Court will be disabled. Effectively as punishment for issuing arrest warrants for Netanyahu and Gallant, his defense minister. But that does not mean that there's going to be no consequences. First of all, in due course, it's in my view almost certain that the International Court of Justice will rule that this has been a genocide. Everything suggests that it will. Now, if that happens, under the Genocide Act, British ministers are going to be, and others, military commanders, the British system will have no choice but to punish them, go after them, because the Genocide Act saying that aiding and abetting a genocide is a criminal offence. Now, they may be protected by the nicety, more than a nicety, that the Attorney General is appointed by the Prime Minister. And therefore, he will be sacked if he decides to go ahead. You'll be political protection. But even if that doesn't happen, I think you're going to find new organizations around the globe, backed by governments, which are going to punish British ministers and other ministers in other countries who have been involved in aiding and abetting a genocide. And you will get red notices suddenly being issued for British ministers or former ministers, possibly prime ministers. One of the darkest, the saddest things actually about recent is that there were no consequences for Britain for embarking on an illegal war, which is the most, according to the Nuremberg trials, the most serious international crime, and an illegal war in Iraq on the basis of lies. And I think it's a pity that there were no consequences for not just for Tony Blair, but also his senior officials around him. I doubt that the current generation of leaders will be so fortunate as Mr. Blair.
Peter Oborne, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.